Welcome to the deep dive. We've got a big one today. Diving deep into kings and prophets, all this material you've given me on it, especially Dr. Van Noy's lectures from the Book of Kings.
Lots to unpack.
Yeah, we've got prophecy and judgment and kingship.
Even some ancient city planning in there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we're going to unpack some pretty intriguing stories, I think, and see what they might mean for us today.
Sounds good. It looks like you've highlighted some really interesting stuff here about the nature of prophecy.
Yeah.
It's often seen as a position, like, you know, you are a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Van Noy suggests we think about it more as a function, like prophesying is something that happens. What do you think about that?
You know, it's interesting because we usually picture a prophet, right, as this person who always speaks for God, like their words are God's words. But then we get this story of the old prophet from 1 Kings 13, and it really challenges that notion.
Yeah.
Like, he actually deceives this man of God from Judah, and it really makes you wonder, can a true prophet ever get things wrong? It's a great question, and it really, I think, gets at the complexity of prophecy. Dr. Van Noy uses the example of Nathan and David's temple, right?
Yeah.
Initially, Nathan encourages David to build the temple, but later God tells Nathan, no, David's not the one to do it. So how do we reconcile these instances where, you know, prophetic messages seem to maybe contradict each other?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, what strikes me is that prophets are still human rights.
Yeah.
They can misunderstand things. They can even let their own opinions color their messages.
Right. And I think that reminds us of the importance of carefully, you know, really thinking through prophetic words and testing them against scripture and the character of God.
For sure. Now, one story that really caught my eye was this account of Elisha and those youths who taunt him, which leads to this rather unsettling bear attack.
Yeah.
It just seems pretty harsh at first glance.
Yeah. It's a story that has generated a lot of discussion, a lot of debate.
Dr. Van Noy connects this event to the broader theme of respecting God's prophets and the consequences of disobedience. Do you think that connection is warranted, or are there other ways of interpreting that story?
Yeah, I mean, well, on the one hand, it's definitely this stark reminder, right, of the seriousness of disrespecting God and those who represent him. But then on the other hand, it's hard to reconcile with the image of a loving and merciful God. How do you sort of wrestle with that tension?
Yeah, it's a tension that runs throughout scripture, right? This balance of God's justice and his mercy.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's not about condoning the violence,
yeah,
you know, but maybe it's more about emphasizing the gravity of rejecting God's messengers and the potential consequences, both for individuals and for the nation as a whole.
That's a really interesting perspective. And it leads us to Ahijah's warning to Jeroboam.
Right.
Dr. Van Noy highlights this covenant lawsuit structure in the prophecy.
Yeah.
He even compares it to ancient Hittite treaty forms. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure. Yeah. So these Hittite treaties often started with a historical prologue outlining the king's gracious acts, followed by stipulations for the vassal's loyalty, blessings for obedience, and curses for disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
And so similarly, in Ahijah's prophecy, you know, he reminds Jeroboam of God's blessings before highlighting his disobedience, specifically his idol worship, and ultimately pronouncing judgment.
So it's almost like God is presenting like a legal case against Jeroboam based on the terms of their covenant.
Exactly.
So it's a powerful way of framing God's interactions with his people.
It is. It emphasizes the importance of covenant faithfulness and the consequences of breaking those sacred bonds. And it really sets the stage for this tumultuous period of the kings that follows.
Speaking of which, we see this rapid succession of kings, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri.
Right.
They have these short reigns that often end violently.
Yeah.
It almost feels like this revolving door of power struggles and betrayals. What insights does Dr. Van Noy offer about this period?
Yeah, he points out that this seemingly chaotic period actually reveals a deeper pattern. Each king's reign is assessed based on their faithfulness to God and their adherence to the covenant.
Okay.
Those who abandoned Yahweh and embraced idolatry faced swift judgment, often through violent overthrows.
So it's a reminder that leadership isn't just about political maneuvering or military prowess.
Right.
It's about spiritual integrity and aligning oneself with God's purposes.
Absolutely. And it highlights the cyclical nature of sin and its consequences.
Right.
When leaders stray from God's ways, the entire nation suffers.
But then we come to Omri, who stands out from this backdrop.
Yeah.
He establishes Samaria as the capital,
right,
achieves a level of stability and prosperity that his predecessors just didn't have. What makes him different? Is it just good luck, or is there something more to it?
That's a great question. Unlike many of his predecessors, Omri isn't specifically commended or condemned for his religious devotion.
Mm.
His legacy rests on his political achievements and strategic thinking. So he chose a strategically advantageous location for Samaria, which contributed to its longevity as a capital city. It even withstood a 3-year siege by the Assyrians.
Wow. So his pragmatic approach and his focus on strengthening the kingdom, even if not explicitly, you know, driven by religious zeal, it had a lasting impact.
Yeah.
It challenges our assumptions about what makes for a successful leader, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Mm-hmm. It suggests that effective leadership can take various forms and that God can use individuals with diverse motivations to accomplish his purposes.
Mm.
What do you think makes a leader truly memorable, regardless of their religious convictions?
You know, I think it comes down to their impact on the people they lead.
Yeah.
Did they leave the kingdom stronger and more prosperous? Did they inspire loyalty and unity? Did they lay a foundation for future generations to thrive?
Oh, those are excellent points. And it leads us to Omri's son, Ahab.
Oh, boy.
Now, he's described as the most wicked king, yet continuing the calf worship and even introducing Baal worship through his marriage to Jezebel.
Jezebel. She's such a captivating figure in this whole saga. She's portrayed as this powerful and ruthless woman who establishes this whole network of Baal prophets and even manipulates the justice system to get her way.
Wow.
What are your thoughts on her influence on Ahab and the kingdom?
I mean, her influence is undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
She represents a significant departure from the traditional Yahwistic faith.
Yeah.
And introduces a major religious crisis in Israel's history.
Right.
She challenges the established order and reshapes the religious landscape of the nation.
And this crisis revolves around the worship of Baal, which Dr. Van Noy portrays as this direct challenge to Yahweh's authority.
Right.
What are the implications of this clash of faiths for Israel?
You know, it's not simply about adding another deity to the pantheon.
Right.
Baal worship represents a fundamentally different worldview. One that clashes with the core tenets of the covenant with Yahweh.
Yeah.
It's a battle for the hearts and minds of the people, a struggle to determine the very identity and destiny of the nation.
It's a fascinating setup for what's to come. We have this tension between faithfulness and disobedience, this clash between Yahweh and Baal, and these compelling characters like Ahab and Jezebel who are shaping the course of events.
Absolutely. And this sets the stage for the emergence of two key figures who will confront this crisis head on, Elijah and Elisha.
Okay.
They represent a turning point in the narrative, and their actions will have far-reaching consequences for the kingdom.
Sounds like we're about to delve into a dramatic showdown between the prophets of Yahweh and the prophets of Baal. I'm eager to unpack this further in part two of our deep dive.
So picking up where we left off, you had highlighted something about this religious crisis in Israel during Ahab's reign. This clash of faiths battle for the allegiance of the people. What was it about this clash that really stood out to you?
Well, you know, it wasn't just about like adding another deity to the mix, Baal worship, as Dr. Van Noy describes. It was alluring because of its emphasis on, you know, fertility and nature promising these tangible benefits like good harvests and prosperity.
Right.
But it also represented this totally different worldview.
Yeah.
You know, one that could really undermine Israel's covenant with Yahweh.
Yeah. It's interesting how Dr. Van Noy points out that Baal worship, it wasn't just about adding a god. It was really this fundamental challenge to the very foundation of Israel's relationship with God.
Yeah, and that makes the roles of Elijah and Elisha even more crucial, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They emerge as these champions of Yahweh directly confronting the prophets of Baal and urging the people to return to true worship. And, I mean, their actions are pretty dramatic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Think about Elijah's challenge on Mount Carmel.
Oh, yeah.
It's just one of those, like, iconic biblical stories that just sticks with you calling down fire from heaven to prove Yahweh's power. What do you think is the significance of that story? I mean, beyond just a display of supernatural power.
Well, for me, it really highlights the contrast between the true God and these false gods.
Right.
Baal's prophets, they're trying all day to get their god to send fire, but nothing happens. Then Elijah prays and boom, fire from heaven consumes the sacrifice. It's just this powerful visual demonstration of who's really in control.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's not just about spectacle, right?
Yeah.
It's about revealing the true nature and power of God. But their ministry wasn't all about these dramatic displays. They also, you know, performed these acts of compassion healing, providing for the needy.
Right.
How do those actions sort of fit into the bigger picture of their prophetic mission?
I think it shows that serving God isn't just about words or even miracles. It's about really like living out his love and compassion for people. Elijah and Elisha embodied that in their actions.
Yeah, they demonstrated that God's power isn't just about judgment or even display, right? It's about meeting the needs of his people and restoring wholeness to their lives.
Yeah, you know, their stories really challenge me to think about what it means to be faithful in my own life. Like, am I willing to stand up for what I believe in, even when it's not popular? Am I showing God's love to the people around me, you know, in practical ways? These are some tough questions.
They are. And that's the beauty of these stories, right? They invite us to really engage with the deeper questions of faith in action. We're not just, you know, reading about these ancient events.
Right.
We're being challenged to really examine our own hearts and our own choices.
Yeah. One point that Dr. Vannoy brings up that I found really interesting is this idea that periods of intense miracles often coincide with significant turning points in redemptive history.
Yeah.
It makes me think, are we living in a time like that? A time ripe for miracles?
Well, that's a question. What do you think? Are there signs of God's activity around us that might suggest a time of spiritual, you know, renewal or awakening?
Well, I mean, I think there's a growing hunger for meaning and purpose, you know, in the world today. People are searching for something beyond just the material and the superficial.
Yeah.
And maybe that creates this opening for God to move in extraordinary ways.
Yeah, perhaps these times of, you know, uncertainty and upheaval are creating this fertile ground for miracles to occur, for God to sort of break through in ways that we haven't seen before. And that raises another question. How might we be called to participate in God's work in ways that we haven't considered before?
Yeah, I think it starts with just being open to the possibility of the miraculous, right?
Right.
Being willing to step outside of our comfort zones and follow where God leads. It might be a small act of kindness, a bold declaration of faith, or something we haven't even imagined yet.
Yeah, that sense of openness and willingness to be surprised by God, that's essential, isn't it?
Totally.
It allows us to be instruments in his hands to participate in the unfolding of his plan.
You know, all this talk about miracles and turning points reminds me of something else that Dr. Vannoy mentioned, the refortification of Jericho by Ahab.
Oh, yeah.
It had been this open city since the conquest, you know, a symbol of God's protection and Israel's trust in him. But then Ahab decides to rebuild the wall, seemingly shifting that trust from God to military. What do you make of that decision?
Well, it's a fascinating detail, and Dr. Vannoy suggests that it symbolizes this shift in mentality.
Okay.
By fortifying Jericho,
yeah,
Ahab seems to be saying, we don't need God's protection. We can take care of ourselves.
It seems almost ironic considering the fate of Jericho during the conquest, right? The walls came tumbling down through divine intervention, not human effort.
Exactly. It highlights this tension that I think we often face, relying on God versus relying on ourselves.
Yeah.
When do we trust in his provision and protection? And when do we try to take matters into our own hands?
Yeah, it's a struggle that I think resonates with a lot of people. How do you navigate that tension in your own life?
It's a continual process of surrender and trust, honestly. Recognizing that my own strength and wisdom are limited, that I need God's guidance and grace every step of the way.
Yeah.
It's about learning to discern when to act and when to wait, when to strive, and when to rest in his promises.
That's a beautiful way to put it. It's a reminder that the journey of faith isn't about achieving perfect self-reliance. It's about surrendering to God's greater wisdom and power.
And that brings us back to the central message of the Book of Kings.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This idea of a covenant relationship with God. It's a relationship marked by both blessings and consequences, requires faithfulness and obedience, but ultimately it's sustained by the grace and power of God himself.
It's been a fascinating exploration of these stories so far. We've covered the nature of prophecy, the rise and fall of kings, the clash between Yahweh and Baal, and the emergence of Elijah and Elisha.
Yeah.
I'm eager to hear what other insights Dr. Vannoy has to offer as we continue this deep dive in part three. So we were talking about this idea of like a, you know, the cyclical nature of power in the Book of Kings. It's like this back and forth, you know, between faithfulness and disobedience, blessing and judgment.
Yeah.
It's a pretty consistent pattern.
It is. And Dr. Vannoy connects it directly to the covenant relationship between God and his people. When the kings honored the covenant, led the people in worship and obedience, the nation flourished. But when they turned away from God, embraced idolatry and injustice, the consequences were pretty swift and often devastating.
It makes you think about the responsibility that comes with leadership, doesn't it? Like their choices didn't just affect them personally. They impacted the entire nation, you know, shaped the spiritual and social fabric of their society.
Absolutely. It makes you think about what we value in leaders today. Are we more drawn to like charisma and power? Or do we prioritize things like integrity, compassion, a commitment to justice.
Yeah.
The kings of Israel offer us this stark contrast between, you know, those who sought their own glory and those who humbly served God and their people.
Yeah. It's a timeless lesson in leadership for sure. But it's not all doom and gloom, right?
Yeah.
We also see these glimpses of hope and restoration even in the midst of all this turmoil, like the story of Omri, who, despite not being particularly devout, established the stable and prosperous kingdom. He even chose a strategic location for the capital, Samaria,
yeah,
which really contributed to its longevity and resilience. What can we learn from his approach to leadership?
It's interesting, right? Because it challenges our assumptions about what makes a leader successful. Omri's legacy wasn't built on piety or religious zeal, but on pragmatism, strategic thinking, and his ability to secure, you know, stability and security for his people. And it's fascinating that Dr. Van Ooy points out that this seemingly secular approach actually had a profound impact on the course of history.
Yeah.
Samaria withstood a 3-year siege by the Assyrians, a testament to the enduring legacy of a leader who prioritized the well-being of his nation.
Yeah. It's a powerful reminder that God can use individuals with diverse motivations and backgrounds, you know, to accomplish his purposes. And it raises an important question. What kind of legacy are we building with our own lives? Are we making choices that will have a positive impact on future generations, even if they don't always stem from explicitly religious motivations?
That's a question worth pondering, isn't it? It challenges us to think beyond our immediate circumstances and consider the long-term consequences of our actions. Mm-hmm. You know, are we building something that will stand the test of time, something that will contribute to the flourishing of others?
It's a humbling thought, and it brings us back to the central message of the Book of Kings. The choices we make matter.
They do.
Whether we're kings or, you know, just ordinary citizens, our decisions have these ripple effects that extend far beyond ourselves. And as we've seen, those choices ultimately reflect our understanding of our relationship with God.
Precisely. The Book of Kings isn't just a collection of ancient stories. It's a mirror reflecting our own struggles with power, faith, the consequences of our choices. It reminds us that we are not alone in this journey. We have a God who is deeply invested in our lives, who offers us guidance and grace, and who calls us to live lives of faithfulness and purpose.
So as we kind of wrap up this deep dive into the Book of Kings, what final thought would you leave with our listener?
You know, these stories, though ancient, they still resonate with questions we grapple with today. The nature of leadership, the struggle for faith, the tension between trusting in divine providence and relying on human strength. As you reflect on the kings and prophets of Israel, consider this. How do their choices, both good and bad, mirror the choices we make today? And what can we learn from their successes and their failures as we navigate the complexities of our own lives and seek to live faithfully in a world that desperately needs God's light?
That's a powerful challenge and a perfect note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the world of kings and prophets. We hope it sparked some new insights and inspired you to continue exploring these timeless stories and their relevance for our lives today.